An Essay on the Development of Christian Doctrine by John Henry Newman. Chapter 4, Part 4. Section 3, The Papal Supremacy. I will take one instance more. Let us see how, on the principles which I have been laying down and defending, the evidence lies for the Pope's supremacy. As to this doctrine, the question is this: whether there was not from the first a certain element at work, or in existence, divinely sanctioned, which for certain reasons did not at once show itself upon the surface of ecclesiastical affairs, and of which events in the fourth century are the development, and whether the evidence of its existence and operation, which does occur in the earlier centuries, be it much or little, is not just such as ought to occur upon such a hypothesis. For instance, it is true St. Ignatius is silent in his epistles on the subject of the Pope's authority. But if, in fact, that authority could not be in active operation then, such silence is not so difficult to account for as the silence of Seneca or Plutarch about Christianity itself, or of Lucian about the Roman people. St. Ignatius directed his doctrine according to the need. While apostles were on earth, there was the display neither of bishop nor pope. Their power had no prominence, as being exercised by apostles. In course of time, first the power of the bishop displayed itself, and then the power of the pope. When the apostles were taken away, Christianity did not at once break into portions. Yet separate localities might begin to be the scene of internal dissensions, and a local arbiter, in consequence, would be wanted. Christians at home did not yet quarrel with Christians abroad. They quarreled at home among themselves. St. Ignatius applied the fitting remedy. The Sacramentum Unitatis was acknowledged on all hands. The modes of fulfilling and the means of securing it would vary with the occasion, and the determination of its essence, its seat, and its laws would be a gradual supply for a gradual necessity. This is but natural, and is parallel to instances which happen daily, and may be so considered, without prejudice to the divine right, whether of the episcopate or of the papacy. It is a common occurrence for a quarrel and a lawsuit to bring out the state of the law, and then the most unexpected results often follow. St. Peter's prerogative would remain a mere letter till the complication of ecclesiastical matters became the cause of ascertaining it. While Christians were of one heart and of one soul, it would be suspended. Love dispenses with laws. Christians knew that they must live in unity, and they were in unity. In what that unity consisted, how far they could proceed, as it were, in bending it, and what at length was the point at which it broke, was an irrelevant as well as unwelcome inquiry. Relatives often live together in happy ignorance of their respective rights and properties till a father or a husband dies, and then they find themselves against their will in separate interests and on divergent courses, and dare not move without legal advisers. Again, the case is conceivable of a corporation or an academical body going on for centuries in the performance of the routine business which came its way, and preserving a good understanding between its members, with statutes almost a dead letter, and no precedents to explain them, and the rights of its various classes and functions undefined. Then of its being suddenly thrown back by the force of circumstances upon the question of its formal character as a body politic, and in consequence developing in the relation of governors and governed. The regalia petri might sleep, as the power of a chancellor has slept. not as an obsolete, for they had never been carried into effect, but as a mysterious privilege which was not understood, as an unfulfilled prophecy. For St. Ignatius to speak of popes when it was a matter of bishops would have been like sending an army to arrest a housebreaker. The bishop's power, indeed, was from God, and the popes could be no more. He, as well as the pope, was our Lord's representative, and had a sacramental office. But I am speaking not of the intrinsic sanctity or divinity of such an office, but of its duties. When the Church, then, was thrown upon her own resources, first, local disturbances gave exercise to bishops, and next, ecumenical disturbances gave exercise to popes. And whether communion with the pope was necessary for Catholicity would not and could not be debated till a suspension of that communion had actually occurred. It is not a greater difficulty that St. Ignatius does not write to the Asian Greeks about popes than that St. Paul does not write to the Corinthians about bishops. And it is a less difficulty that the papal supremacy was not formally acknowledged in the second century than that there was no formal acknowledgment on the part of the Church of the doctrine of the Holy Trinity till the fourth. No doctrine is defined until it is violated. And in like manner, it was natural for Christians to direct their course in matters of doctrine by the guidance of mere floating and, as it were, endemic tradition, while it was fresh and strong, but in proportion as it languished or was broken in particular places, did it become necessary to fall back upon its special homes, first the Apostolic Sees, and then the See of St. Peter. Moreover, an international bond and a common authority could not be consolidated were it ever so certainly provided, while persecutions lasted. If the imperial power checked the development of councils, it availed also for keeping back the power of the papacy. The creed, the canon, in like manner, both remained undefined. The creed, the canon, the papacy, ecumenical councils, all began to form as soon as the empire relaxed its tyrannous oppression of the Church. And as it was natural that her monarchical power should display itself when the empire became Christian, so was it natural that also that further developments of that power should take place when the empire fell. Moreover, when the power of the Holy See began to exert itself, disturbance and collision would be the necessary consequence. Of the Temple of Solomon it was said that neither hammer nor axe nor any tool of iron was heard in the house while it was in building. This is a type of the church above. It was otherwise with the church below, whether in the instance of popes or apostles. In either case, a new power had to be defined, as St. Paul had to plead, nay, to strive for his apostolic authority, and enjoined St. Timothy, as bishop of Ephesus, to let no man despise him. So popes, too, have not, therefore, been ambitious, because they did not establish their authority without a struggle. It was natural that Polycrates should oppose St. Victor, and natural, too, that St. Cyprian should both extol the See of St. Peter, yet resist it when he thought it went beyond its province. And, at a later day, it was natural that emperors should rise in indignation against it, and natural, on the other hand, that it should take higher ground with a younger power than it had taken with an elder and time-honored. We may follow Barrow here without reluctance, except in his imputation of motives. "In the first times," he says, "while the emperors were pagans, their, the popes, pretenses were suited to their condition, and could not soar high. They were not then so mad as to pretend to any temporal power, and a pittance of spiritual eminency did then content them." Again, "the state of the most primitive church did not well admit such a universal sovereignty, for that did consist of small bodies incoherently situated, and scattered about in very distant places, and consequently unfit to be modelled into one political society, or to be governed by one head, especially considering their condition under persecution and poverty. What convenient resort for direction or justice could a few distressed Christians in Egypt, Ethiopia, Parthia, India, Mesopotamia, Syria, Armenia, Cappadocia, and other parts, have to Rome?" Again, "whereas no point avowed by Christians could be so apt to raise offence and jealousy in pagans against our religion as this, which setteth up a power of so vast extent and huge influence. Whereas no novelty could be more surprising or startling than the creation of a universal empire over the consciences and religious practices of men. Whereas also this doctrine could not be but very conspicuous and glaring in ordinary practice, it is prodigious that all pagans should not loudly exclaim against it," that is, on the supposition that the papal power really was then in actual exercise. And again, "it is most prodigious that in the disputes managed by the fathers against heretics, the Gnostics, Valentinians, etc., they should not, even in the first place, allege and urge the sentence of the universal pastor and judge as a most evidently conclusive argument, as the most efficacious and compendious method of convincing and silencing them." Once more, "even popes themselves have shifted their pretenses and varied in style, according to the different circumstances of time, and their variety of humours, designs, interests. In time of prosperity, and upon advantage, when they might safely do it, any pope almost would talk high, and assume much to himself. But when they were low, or stood in fear of powerful contradiction, even the boldest popes would speak submissively or moderately. On the whole, supposing the power to be divinely bestowed, yet in the first instance more or less dormant, a history could not be traced out more probable, more suitable, to that hypothesis than the actual course of the controversy which took place, age after age, upon the papal supremacy." It will be said that all this is a theory. Certainly it is. It is a theory to account for facts as they lie in the history, to account for so much being told us about the papal authority in early times, and not more. A theory to reconcile what is and what is not recorded about it, and, which is the principal point, a theory to connect the words and acts of the anti-Nicene Church with that antecedent probability of a monarchical principle in the divine scheme, and that actual exemplification of it in the 4th century, which forms their presumptive interpretation. All depends on the strength of that presumption. Supposing there be otherwise good reason for saying that the papal supremacy is part of Christianity, there is nothing in the early history of the Church to contradict it. It follows to inquire in what this presumption consists. It has, as I have said, two parts: the antecedent probability of a popedom, and the actual state of the post-Nicene Church. The former of these reasons has unavoidably been touched upon in what has preceded. It is the absolute need of a monarchical power in the Church which is our ground for anticipating it. A political body cannot exist without government, and the larger is the body, the more concentrated must the government be. If the whole of Christendom is to form one kingdom, one head is essential. At least, this is the experience of 1800 years. As the Church grew into form, so did the power of the Pope develop. And wherever the Pope has been renounced, decay and division have been the consequence. We know of no other way of preserving the Sacramentum Unitatis but a center of unity. The Nestorians have had their Catholicus. The Lutherans of Prussia have their general superintendent. Even the Independents, I believe, have had an overseer in their missions. The Anglican Church affords an observable illustration of this doctrine. As her prospects have opened and her communion extended, the See of Canterbury has become the natural center of her operations. It has at the present time jurisdiction in the Mediterranean, at Jerusalem, in Hindostan, in North America, at the Antipodes. It has been the organ of a communication when a prime minister would force the Church to a redistribution of her property, or a Protestant sovereign abroad would bring her into friendly relations with his own communion. Eyes have been lifted up thither in times of perplexity. Thither have addresses been directed and deputations sent. Thence issue the legal decisions, or the declarations in Parliament, or the letters, or the private interpositions, which shape the fortunes of the Church, and are the moving influence within her separate dioceses. It must be so. No church can do without its pope. We see before our eyes the centralizing process by which the See of St. Peter became the sovereign head of Christendom. If such be the nature of the case, it is impossible, if we may so speak reverently, that an infinite wisdom which sees the end from the beginning in decreeing the rise of a universal empire should not have decreed the development of a sovereign ruler. Moreover, all this must be viewed in the light of the general probability, so much insisted on above, that doctrine cannot but develop as time proceeds and need arises, and that its developments are parts of the divine system, and that therefore it is lawful, or rather necessary, to interpret the words and deeds of the earlier Church by the determinate teaching of the latter. And on the other hand, as the counterpart of these anticipations, we are met by certain announcements in Scripture, more or less obscure and needing a comment, and claimed by the papal see as having their fulfillment in itself. Such are the words, "Thou art Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. And I will give unto thee the keys of the kingdom of heaven." Again, "Feed my lambs, feed my sheep." And, "Satan hath desired to have you. I have prayed for thee, and when thou art converted, strengthen thy brethren." Such, too, are various other indications of the divine purpose as regards St. Peter, too weak in themselves to be insisted on separately, but not without a confirmatory power, such as his new name, his walking on the sea, his miraculous draught of fishes on two occasions, our Lord's preaching out of his boat, and his appearing first to him after the resurrection. It should be observed, moreover, that a similar promise was made by the patriarch Jacob to Judah. Thou art he whom thy brethren shall praise. The scepter shall not depart from Judah till Shiloh come. Yet this promise was not fulfilled for perhaps 800 years, during which long period we hear little or nothing of the tribe descended from him. In like manner, on this rock I will build my church. I give unto thee the keys. Feed my sheep. Are not precepts merely, but prophecies and promises, promises to be accomplished by him who made them, prophecies to be fulfilled according to the need, and to be interpreted by the event, by the history, that is, of the 4th and 5th centuries, though they had a partial fulfillment even in the preceding period, and a still more noble development in the Middle Ages. A partial fulfillment, or at least indications of what was to be, there certainly were in the First Age. Faint one by one, at least they are various, and are found in writers of many times and countries, and thereby illustrative of each other, and forming a body of proof. Thus St. Clement, in the name of the Church of Rome, writes to the Corinthians when they were without a bishop. St. Ignatius of Antioch addresses the Roman Church, out of the churches to which he writes, as the church which has in dignity the first seat of the city of the Romans, and implies that it was too high for his directing as being the church of St. Peter and St. Paul. St. Polycarp of Smyrna has recourse to the Bishop of Rome on the question of Easter. The heretic Marcion, excommunicated in Pontus, betakes himself to Rome. Soter, Bishop of Rome, sends alms, according to the custom of his church, to the churches throughout the empire, and, in the words of Eusebius, affectionately exhorted those who came to Rome as a father his children. The Montanists from Phrygia come to Rome to gain the countenance of its bishop. Praxius from Asia attempts the like, and for a while is successful. St. Victor, Bishop of Rome, threatens to excommunicate the Asian churches. St. Irenaeus speaks of Rome as the greatest church, the most ancient, the most conspicuous, and founded and established by Peter and Paul. Appeals to its tradition, not in contrast indeed, but in preference to that of other churches, and declares that to this church, every church, that is, the faithful from every side, must resort, or must agree with it, propter potiorem principalitatem. O church, happy in its position, says Tertullian, into which the apostles poured out, together with their blood, their whole doctrine. And elsewhere, though in indignation and bitter mockery, he calls the Pope the Pontifex Maximus, the Bishop of Bishops. The presbyters of St. Dionysius, Bishop of Alexandria, complain of his doctrine to St. Dionysius of Rome. The latter expostulates with him, and he explains. The Emperor Aurelian leaves, to the bishops of Italy and of Rome, the decision whether or not Paul of Samosata shall be dispossessed of the see-house at Antioch. St. Cyprian speaks of Rome as the see of Peter and the principal church, whence the unity of the priesthood took its rise, whose faith has been commended by the apostles, to whom faithlessness can have no access. St. Stephen refuses to receive St. Cyprian's deputation, and separates himself from various churches of the East. Fortunatus and Felix, deposed by St. Cyprian, have recourse to Rome. Basilides, deposed in Spain, betakes himself to Rome and gains the ear of St. Stephen. St. Cyprian has his quarrel with the Roman See, but it appears he allows to it the title of the Cathedra Petri, and even Firmilian is a witness that Rome claimed it. In the 4th and 5th centuries, this title and its logical results became prominent. Thus, St. Julius, A.D. 342, remonstrated by letter with the Eusebian party for proceeding on their own authority as they pleased. And then, as he says, desiring to obtain our concurrence in their decisions, though we never condemned Athanasius. Not so have the constitutions of Paul, not so have the traditions of the fathers directed. This is another form of procedure, a novel practice. For what we have received from the blessed Apostle Peter, that I signify to you. And I should not have written this, as deeming that these things are manifest unto all men, had not these proceedings so disturbed us. St. Athanasius, by preserving this protest, has given it his sanction. Moreover, it is referred to by Socrates, and his account of it has the more force, because he happens to be incorrect in the details, and therefore did not borrow it from St. Athanasius. Julius wrote back, he says, that they acted against the canons because they had not called him to the council, the ecclesiastical canon commanding that the churches ought not to make canons beside the will of the Bishop of Rome. And Sozomen? It was a sacerdotal law to declare invalid whatever was transacted beside the will of the Bishop of the Romans. On the other hand, the heretics themselves, whom St. Julius withstands, are obliged to acknowledge that Rome was the school of the apostles and the metropolis of orthodoxy from the beginning. And two of their leaders, Western bishops indeed, some years afterwards recanted their heresy before the Pope in terms of humble confession. Another pope, St. Damasus, in his letter addressed to the Eastern bishops against Apollinaris, A.D. 382, calls those bishops his sons. In that your charity pays the due reverence to the apostolical see, ye profit yourselves the most, most honored sons. For if, placed as we are in that holy church in which the holy apostle sat and taught, how it becometh us to direct the helm to which we have succeeded. We nevertheless confess ourselves unequal to that honor. Yet do we therefore study as we may, if so be we may be able to attain to the glory of his blessedness. I speak, says St. Jerome to the same St. Damasus, with the successor of the fisherman and the disciple of the cross. I, following no one as my chief but Christ, am associated in communion with thy blessedness, that is, with the See of Peter. I know that on that rock the church is built. Whoever shall eat the lamb outside this house is profane. If a man be not in the ark of Noah, he shall perish when the flood comes in its power. St. Basil entreats St. Damasus to send persons to arbitrate between the churches of Asia Minor, or at least to make a report on the authors of their troubles, and name the party with which the Pope should hold communion. We are in no wise asking anything new, he proceeds, but what was customary with blessed and religious men of former times, and especially with yourself. For we know, by tradition of our fathers of whom we have inquired, and from the information of writings still preserved among us, that Dionysius, that most blessed bishop, while he was eminent among you for orthodoxy and other virtues, sent letters of visitation to our church at Caesarea, and of consolation to our fathers, with ransomers of our brethren from captivity. In like manner, Ambrosiaster, a Pelagian in his doctrine, which here is not to the purpose, speaks of the church being God's house, whose ruler at this time is Damasus. We bear, says St. Siricius, another pope, A.D. 385, the burden of all who are laden. Yea, rather, the blessed apostle Peter beareth them in us, who, as we trust, in all things protects and defends us, the heirs of his government. And he, in turn, is confirmed by St. Optatus. You cannot deny your knowledge, says the latter to Parmenion the Donatist, that in the city Rome on Peter first hath an episcopal see been conferred, in which Peter sat, the head of all the apostles, in which one see, unity might be preserved by all, lest the other apostles should support their respective sees, in order that he might be at once a schismatic and a sinner, who against that one see, singularum, placed a second. Therefore that one see, unicam, which is the first of the church's prerogatives, Peter filled first, to whom succeeded Linus, to Linus Clement, to Clement, etc., etc., to Damasus Siricius, who at this day is associated with us, Socius, together with whom the whole world is in accordance with us in the one bond of communion by the intercourse of letters of peace. Another pope. Diligently and congruously do you consult the Arianna of the apostolical dignity, says St. Innocent to the Council of Milevis, A.D. 417. The dignity of him on whom, beside those things which are without, falls the care of all the churches, following the form of the ancient rule, which you know as well as I, has been preserved always by the whole world. Here the Pope appeals, as it were, to the rule of Vincentius, while St. Augustine bears witness that he did not outstep his prerogative, for giving an account of this and another letter, he says, He, the Pope, answered us as to all these matters, as it was religious and becoming in the bishop of the apostolic see. Another Pope. We have special anxiety about all persons, says St. Celestine, A.D. 425, to the Illyrian bishops, on whom in the holy apostle Peter Christ conferred the necessity of making all men our care, when he gave him the keys of opening and shutting. And St. Prosper, his contemporary, confirms him when he calls Rome the seat of Peter, which being made to the world the head of pastoral honor, possesses by religion what it does not possess by arms. And Vincent of Larens, when he calls the Pope the head of the world. Another Pope. Blessed Peter, says St. Leo, A.D. 440, etc., hath not deserted the helm of the church which he had assumed. His power lives, and his authority is preeminent in his see. That immovableness which from the rock Christ, he, when made a rock, received, has been communicated also to his heirs. And, as St. Athanasius and the Eusebians, by their contemporary testimonies, confirm St. Julius, and St. Jerome, St. Basil, and Ambrosiaster, St. Damasus, and St. Optatus, St. Siricius, and St. Augustine, St. Innocent, and St. Prosper and Vincent, St. Celestine, so do St. Peter Chrysologus and the Council of Chalcedon confirm St. Leo. Blessed Peter, says Chrysologus, who lives and presides in his own see, supplies truth of faith to those who seek it. And the Ecumenical Council of Chalcedon, addressing St. Leo respecting Dioscorus, Bishop of Alexandria, he extends his madness even against him to whom the custody of the vineyard has been committed by the Savior, that is, against thy apostolical holiness. But the instance of St. Leo will occur again in a later chapter. The Acts of the 4th century speak as strongly as its words. We may content ourselves here with Barrow's admissions. The Pope's power, he says, was much amplified by the importunity of persons condemned or extruded from their places, whether upon just accounts or wrongfully, and by faction. For they, finding no more hopeful place of refuge and redress, did often apply to him. For what will not men do? Whither will not they go in straits? Thus did Marcion go to Rome, and sue for admission to communion there. So Fortunatus and Felicissimus in St. Cyprian, being condemned in Africa, did fly to Rome for shelter. Of which absurdity St. Cyprian doth so complain. So likewise Marcianus and Basilides in St. Cyprian, being outed of their sees for having lapsed from the Christian profession, did fly to Stephen for succor to be restored. So Maximus the Cynic went to Rome to get a confirmation of his election at Constantinople. So Marcellus, being rejected for heterodoxy, went thither to get attestation to his orthodoxy, of which St. Basil complaineth. So Apiarus, being condemned in Africa for his crimes, did appeal to Rome. And on the other side, Athanasius, being with great partiality condemned by the Synod of Tyre, Paulus and other bishops being extruded from their sees for orthodoxy, St. Chrysostom being condemned and expelled by Theophilus and his accomplices, Flavianus being deposed by Dioscorus and the Ephesine Synod, Theodoret being condemned by the same, did cry out for help to Rome. Caledonius, Bishop of Besancon, being deposed by Hilarius of Arles for crime, did fly to Pope Leo. Again, our adversaries do oppose some instances of popes meddling in the constitution of bishops, as Pope Leo I saith that Anatolius did, by the favor of his assent, obtain the bishopric of Constantinople. The same pope is alleged as having confirmed Maximus of Antioch. The same doth write to the bishop of Thessalonica, his vicar, that he should confirm the elections of bishops by his authority. He also confirmed Donatus, an African bishop. We will that Donatus preside over the Lord's flock, upon condition that he remember to send us an account of his faith. Pope Damasus did confirm the ordination of Peter Alexandrinus. And again, the popes, indeed, in the 4th century, began to practice a fine trick, very serviceable to the enlargement of their power, which was to confer on certain bishops, as occasion served, or for continuance, the title of their vicar or lieutenant, thereby pretending to impart authority to them, whereby they were enabled for performance of divers things which otherwise, by their own episcopal or metropolitical power, they could not perform. By which device they did engage such bishops to such a dependence on them, whereby they did promote the papal authority in provinces, to the oppression of the ancient rights and liberties of bishops and synods, doing what they pleased under pretense of this vast power communicated to them. And for fear of being displaced, or out of affection for their favour, doing what might serve to advance the papacy. Thus did Pope Celestine constitute Cyril in his room. Pope Leo appointed Anatolius of Constantinople. Pope Felix, Acacius of Constantinople. Pope Simplicius to Zeno, Bishop of Severin. We thought it convenient that you should be held up by the vicariate authority of our see. So did Siricius and his successors constitute the bishops of Thessalonica to be their vicars in the diocese of Illyricum, wherein, being then a member of the Western Empire, they had caught a special jurisdiction, to which Pope Leo did refer in those words which sometimes are impertinently alleged with reference to all bishops, but concern only Anastasius, Bishop of Thessalonica. We have entrusted thy charity to be in our stead, so that thou art called into part of the solicitude, not into plenitude of the authority. So did Pope Zosimus bestow a like pretense of vicarious power upon the Bishop of Arles, which city was the seat of the temporal exarch in Gaul. More ample testimony for the papal supremacy, as now professed by Roman Catholics, is scarcely necessary than what is contained in these passages. The simple question is whether the clear light of the 4th and 5th centuries may be fairly taken to interpret to us the dim though definite outlines traced in the preceding. End of chapter 4.